Thank you very much. I hope I can avoid being turned blinded by the lights and still be able to say something. I had a choice between moving over there or just sitting here, and I think probably it's better for me to sit here. But it's really great where you left in terms of the societal change, because what I want to talk about is in terms of Pakistan and why what's happening is happening. And I guess where I want to go back to is my early childhood when in Balochistan or in Quetta. I remember going to a school which was called an Islamia school, so by name it's a religious, sort of, it's got some, it's not a religious school, but it had a religious basis to its creation. And being invited by a friend who wanted me to go to her place because it was Diwali. As a very young kid who had no idea what Diwali was, I do remember going there and enjoying. And this was at the heart of a city, in a school with an Islamic background. If we move from there into today's society in Pakistan, what do we see? I think anyone who opens any newspapers or any other information that deals with Pakistan, you hear lots and lots of stories of people being killed because they're non-Muslims, people being killed or attacked because they have blasphemed or they've been perceived to engage in blasphemy, people being killed because they are Sunnis or people being killed because they are Shias. Why is it that it's happening? And I just think if we are talking about religious freedom in a developing country with a Muslim majority, I don't think you can just simply look at the explanation in terms of the nature of the religion and the way people are. I think we have to go beyond that to understand what is happening in the society that has shifted from the place that I grew up in to the one where it's not permissible. In fact, if anything, I'm quite sort of, not intrigued, in fact, quite disturbed when I find people telling me that you need to be careful visiting Shia friends because they are under threat. So by simple association with Shia friends, you could be under threat yourself. I think one of the answers that I think we need to go to is the continuous deterioration in the economic condition and the failure of hope in Pakistan. And I think the continuous economic deterioration really draws me into this understanding that if we look at Pakistan, created in 1947 with a lot of hope for a country of Muslims, not an Islamic state, really expected to play its part in the international system. Starting from very poor background with the Foreign Office probably just having one typewriter to conduct their whole foreign policy to one where they have a much nicer building. But in that point, when they started, there was this sense that you have a right to play your role in the international system and domestically. And there was this also sense that Pakistan is able to bring on all the human resources that it had, building on the educational system that they had on their own in terms of Islamic background, but also in terms of the British education that they acquired, that they were going to play their role in the international system. And I think in some ways, irrespective of the governmental changes, for example, the introduction of authoritarianism with the first military coup in 1958, the reality is that in the 1960s, Pakistan was still seen as a shining example of development in Asia. So all the countries that today are seen as being very significant in Asia were in fact learning from Pakistan. But that hope and that promise of development, I think, gradually started eroding. One could argue that, in fact, the very hope that created Pakistan got undermined by the questions within the state as to what does it mean to have a state for Muslims. The debate for an Islamic state created space for religious clergy who were not very important in the creation of Pakistan to stake a claim and in that sense really start introducing norms that maybe they were at the sociological grassroots level but weren't really engaged into the political stream, but they started pushing it into the political stream. Just listening of that and the language of that, I think, started increasing the space for religious ideas in the system. But I think at the same time, the very factors which created economic development in Pakistan also created conditions for economic lack of development. Economic inequality created classes. In those days, people used to talk about a limited, I think, 200 families or 100 families that had the money and everyone else was poor. that that development in itself, therefore, created a situation of inequality. If we see the way Pakistan has moved across all these decades, what we find is that that trend, in fact, hasn't really shifted. The number of poor people in Pakistan, depending upon different figures that you see, have either increased or they have decreased. But the reality is that if you look at the incidence of poverty, it has definitely increased. And I would say that it's not just simply incidence of poverty that you can actually judge in terms of numbers, but incidence of poverty in terms of how people feel that they have the ability to live their life along the standards that they felt was acceptable, or that they expect of their, using a very statist language, within their class. Middle class poverty, I think, is a rising phenomenon in Pakistan. Increasing electricity bills, increasing cost of the food, limited amount of money that they get, especially if you're employed in the government, makes it very difficult for someone who's in the middle class to retain some sort of semblance of self-respect. What about the poor people? I think poor people have in fact been even more violated in this whole process. With the government's inefficiency and lack of management, effectively what we come up to a situation is that poor people, in lots of ways, with the rising food costs, have really gone into the space where they're cutting down on their expectation of even living. And in that, I think, I often remember this gardener of ours who comes in sort of regularly and sort of does the work. When I went back to him, and we were just having this simple chat, and I think it was so instructive that I haven't forgotten. He was talking about some money that he had sort of a few months ago, and then this time when I saw him, he said it had almost finished. So I looked at him and I said, "How did you finish it?" And he said, "My stomach needs something." And it was so sort of strong for me in terms of somebody saying, you know, you have a different sense of life. Look at me. I need food. And since then, I think I've started observing a lot. Now, why am I talking about this? I think when we look at rights of minorities being violated, when we look at how Pakistan is shifting into space that it wasn't even in the 1960s, we cannot divorce ourselves from this increasing poverty incidence, direct, indirect, obvious, and hidden, that has created a sense of hopelessness among people. That sense of hopelessness coexists with extreme income inequalities. And when I say extreme income inequalities, some of you probably, especially those who are from the region, would understand, but extreme income inequalities in the extent that people of the upper class would spend 100,000 rupees without thinking on one outfit that women probably would wear twice, and that's about it. 100,000 people borrow in poor class to marry their children off, and they literally live their whole life trying to repay that money, or they have to find an alternative means. I think, what does it introduce? It introduces hopelessness, but it introduces a search for a way of expressing your disillusionment, your anger, your frustration. I think the state in itself, right through the system, has really started weakening. The state has been taken over by people, not that they weren't there before, but a number of people who have been in the state have been taken over by those who are more interested in retaining their own position. So the corruption in the system has enabled them to retain power and not really look at the needs of the poor people. In that environment of the state giving up on the people, and the people having no sense of stability or sense of expressing their hope in the system, I think, what do? You find ways of being violent. And in that case, I think we're talking about violence against religious minorities, but I think we have to talk about violence against women, violence against children, violence against anything that is different. And that level of violence that I think has increased in Pakistan cannot just simply be explained in religious terms. It's got very strong sociological, psychological, economic, and political basis that we need to understand. Now, when I'm saying that, am I excusing whatever is happening in Pakistan? No. I think it's the responsibility of everyone, and I'm glad Asif talked about it, of the educated and uneducated class to say violence against anyone in terms of the difference, whether it's economic, cultural or religious, is unacceptable. But the trouble is that I think people are caught in the situation where it's become very difficult. Does this mean that the state is in a state of being frozen? Interestingly, given the fact that religion has become an issue internationally, and especially Islam, there's a very interesting phenomenon which the state in itself, against the established currents of violence against minorities of all kinds, has at least tried to do something that indicates that it is for religious equality. We cannot ignore the fact that during Musharraf's time period, irrespective of all the other blunders that he committed, he did create at least a sense that Christian minorities were as much Pakistanis as others. One thing that it introduced into the society, and again we could argue that it's a very elitist specific change, but what it has done is that during Christmas time, you go to all the 5-star hotels and they've got these beautiful Christmas trees and they have carols going on, which was never done before. So the state has tried to do something about it, just to try and shift people in a different space. Television channels now regularly promote religious events held. Interestingly, Baha'is and maybe Ahmadis, they are sort of still outside that whole space, but it's not totally ignored. The last point, and then I'll stop. Given the fact that my work is basically Pakistan and religious minorities, Muslim minorities in the West, one connection that I've talked about, and I'm glad, Naz, you were trying to broaden that whole debate, is that when we look at Muslim minorities in the West, having been exposed to ideas of religious freedom and in lots of ways demanding that they have a right to have a voice in the system, I'm quite perturbed by the fact that Muslim minorities in the West tend to be, at least, and I'm referring specifically to Pakistanis, tend to be silent spectators of what's happening back in their country vis-a-vis the religious minority issues. There are very few voices that are raised saying it is not okay to be done to them what we think is being done to us. What does that do? It creates a space only for the Christian minorities, especially, to come into Western liberal spaces to say Christian minorities are being violated or Ahmadis are being violated. So it actually creates the division within the minorities in liberal societies. I think that needs to change. I'll stop there before you come and stop me. Thank you.